Social media companies can now continue to lawfully detect and report child sex abuse material after a temporary solution was agreed at EU level. To discuss this and writing in this matter is the Cormac O'Keefe. He's security correspondent at the Irish Examiner. Cormac, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
Cormac, this is a temporary solution. Why was there a pause placed on social media companies making reports of what are very grave crimes?
Yeah, the issue came to light last December when a new electronics communication code was passed in the EU, and that had very strict privacy laws underpinning it. And before that, the social media companies had a system of scanning the content of messages for child sex abuse material and indicators of grooming. This was something they were doing voluntarily themselves and reporting their report to the authorities and to the police to investigate. But once this code was introduced, there was no legal basis for the companies to continue doing what they were doing, and very quickly it became a very serious problem that was flagged by children's charities. And the EU Commissioner for Home Affairs, Ylva Johansson, led the charge on this, that it needed to be changed, a specific exemption needed to be put in place that would allow the companies to continue what they were doing.
And Cormac, was this a lacuna, was this an oversight in the development of the code that was introduced in December, or was it planned to allow social media companies to report these kinds of crimes in a different way?
No, it seems to have been an unintended consequence of the directive, because obviously the power to scan, you know, content of your messages is a serious infringement of your privacy rights. So there were genuine reasons why there was no exemption there for this specific issue. Why it wasn't factored in initially, I'm not quite clear. But there was a major rush after it emerged to get the problem fixed, and it's taken a number of months for that to happen in the European Parliament. Only passed this yesterday or the day before yesterday, the agreement that had been hammered out. But a number of police authorities have raised it. Five countries such as the United States and New Zealand and Australia and the United Kingdom also flagged it, because they have been trying to address this particular issue as well. So we seem to have what you call a temporary fix, which will be in place for 3 years, by which time the Commission has said he plans to bring in permanent laws specifically on this issue.
And drafting of those laws, Cormac, will be, I imagine, quite legally and technically challenging, because as you've pointed out, the original technical document announced in December, which created this situation, is there to safeguard people's privacy and the ability to scan messages for certain keywords, etc., is an infringement on people's privacy. So whatever permanent fix is brought in is going to have to tread a very, very thin line.
Yeah, it is, and this is an area that has, I suppose, come to the fore in related issues over recent years, and it is obviously legally a very tricky area, and of course it might set precedent that privacy campaigners might be concerned about that could spill over into other areas, and there's a lot of concern about mass surveillance and the ability to intercept communications, even encrypted phones. So there's a lot of issues, I suppose, being decided in the European Parliament and also in the European courts on this particular issue. Now, there are additional privacy safeguards that are in place following this agreement, and the national authorities have a role. People can make a complaint if they feel their privacy has been breached. But I suppose there's a very large sector of the population that feel that, you know, the rights of children, particularly when it comes to protection because it should take precedent over any other right. But obviously there's a balance to be struck.
And in terms of children's rights and crimes perpetrated against children, the reports of child sexual abuse material dropped between December and the institution of this temporary fix, which shows its effect on the social media platforms' abilities to make reports, and thus one would imagine it would have a knock-on effect on the authority in each individual state's ability to investigate them.
Yeah, I mean, if the authorities don't get the reports, they have nothing to investigate. So Ylva Johansson earlier in the year said that the number of reports dropped from over 30,000 in the 6 weeks prior to the passing of the directive to less than 14,000 up until early February of this year. So earlier this week, she said the overall number had dropped by 53%, which is obviously a colossal number. And to put that in some kind of scale, many of the reports that are given to the policing authorities, including the Gardaí, come from the National Centre for Missing and Exploited Children in the States. They are the sort of focal point for reports in this area. And for the first 9 months of 2020, 2.3 million of their reports related to either an offender or a child victim in the EU. And this is a huge source of intelligence and information for our guards, because Ms. Johansson previously said 80% of the reports that Gardaí received come from that US centre. So it has real consequence, or has had real consequence, and hopefully with this fix that will resolve the matter.
Well, Cormac O'Keefe, security correspondent in the Irish Examiner, and as I noted, writing on this matter in that publication. Thank you indeed for joining us. Now, it seems that households are getting hit with price increases at virtually every hand's turn, depending on your service or utility provider. The CSO has released very unhappy news about an increase in inflation. And to discuss all of this, joined on the line by Charlie Weston, personal finance editor at the Irish Independent. Charlie, you're welcome.
Thanks, Ciara.
So we have price increases announced in the last couple of weeks by Electric Ireland for both its gas and electricity. Bord Gáis again for its gas and electricity. Air is the latest. Its prices are going up by 8% in September. And then the CSO tells us inflation is up and most prices are up by around 1.6%. It's not a happy time to be trying to watch the pennies in Ireland.
No, it's not. And if you're on the pub payment, it's very difficult. Yeah, you're right. There's a slew of price rises coming through at the moment. Now, some of this is what's to be expected. It's post-pandemic stuff, you know, and the likes of the European Central Bank President Christine Lagarde says it's temporary and it won't last, but we just don't know that. But certainly what we're seeing at the moment is a slew of price increases. I mean, you had Air yesterday announcing that they will increase broadband prices and telephone prices for most of their customers from September. You're talking about €72 a year there in the increase in cost. You Bord Gáis announcing a second electricity rise this year, plus pushing up gas. And we're talking about extraordinary high levels of increases as well. This time, electricity is going up 11.6%.
Oh,
gas is going up 12.7%. I mean, they're extraordinary rises. We saw something similar last week from Electric Ireland. Most of the energy providers have increased their costs. Petrol is up about 20%. Diesel up a little bit more at the pumps as well. Health insurance has been going up. And you know, rents as well. I mean, there's a whole slew of things becoming more expensive. So a very difficult time. And you're right, there's new figures out this morning from the Central Statistics Office showing that in June prices rose for the eighth month in a row. The consumer price index now is rising at a rate of 1.6% when compared with the same month last year, and that's put down to petrol, diesel, household energy. They're the things that are rising quite a lot. I mean, you know, with some of this Brexit, some of this is shortage of raw materials, and some of it is businesses having to spend an awful lot more to observe pandemic protocol, so it's costing more. But you know, wholesale crude oil prices are way up, and haulage prices are up, and international shipping costs are up. So, you know, all of this is just feeding into higher prices.
And the only bit of this, to hearken back to Christine Lagarde, that feels temporary is perhaps the additional cost some businesses may have occurred in reopening. Everything else feels a little bit more longer term.
Well, you'd hope, you know, there's shortages in terms of raw materials, and that's due to shutdowns, due to Brexit. You'd hope that'll work itself through, you know. I mean, we just haven't been able to process or make stuff in the world because of lockdowns, essentially. And there's an issue around shipping costs, and, you know, there's a shortage of shipping availability. You'd hope that, that maybe that could work itself out as well. And crude oil prices are very high at the moment. Some of that's got to do with a spat within OPEC. You know, they're rowing with each other, especially Saudi Arabia and UAE, about what the levels of production. So, you know, that's certainly sent the barrel of crude oil up 60% this year to something like $76 a barrel. I mean, and, you know, you'd hope that maybe if that came back, maybe. But on the other hand, Kerry, you're right. I mean, you know, some of this could stay, be there for a while. Prices often go up and very seldom come down.
Yeah. And the combined, there's very few households that will be able to escape these rises, and combined, like, even just the, if you're an air customer who happens to be with Bord Gáis, that's, you know, €320 or thereabouts a year, dependent upon the average household. Throw in the 20% extra in petrol or diesel costs. This is several hundred a year for per household. That's not accounting for the inflation in, let's say, food prices or transport.
Exactly. And, you know, you're already starting from a base where we're the second most expensive country for goods and services in the European Union. You know, we're way up there in terms of what it costs. Denmark is the most expensive, but Ireland is extremely expensive. We have the most expensive alcohol, for example. Prices are 36% higher here than in other EU countries. But there are some mitigating ways of dealing with this. I mean, you could, for example, make sure that you're on the best tariff for your electricity and gas that you can be on. I mean, you know, there's something like 11 suppliers in the market, so make sure you're not paying a high tariff. Even though they're increasing their prices, it is still worth your while shopping around. You can save a couple of hundred euros on that. You know, when your insurance renewal comes in for your motor car, don't just accept what they're saying because it's always a try-on. Get online or ring up a good broker and try and see if you can get a better price and go back to them and see if they'll match it. If not, go to somebody else. You know, if you're buying stuff in shops, don't be buying the branded stuff. That tends to be the terribly expensive stuff. I mean, there's always own labels, which tend to be much better value, you know. And try and work through your debt, you know, your high expensive debt, like credit cards and stuff. So there are things we can do for ourselves. I mean, the other thing is, there's figures out today from the Environmental Protection Agency. The average household throws away €700 worth of food every year.
I know, we are terrible for that.
And it's
like in my household as well. I'm not, you know, trying to say I'm not guilty of it as everybody else, but it's such a huge amount of money and a vast amount of waste that really is within our control for the most part.
It is, you're absolutely right. Now, I have a dog, I have a Labrador, and I hold a Labrador, and he eats anything that isn't eaten by the humans. But, you know, not everybody has a kind of waste disposal unit like that. But we do. I mean, a lot of it, sometimes in summer especially, we're not storing vegetables and fruit and salads properly, probably, and they go off very quickly, and we just chuck them out. I mean, but €700 in food waste, you know, from an environmental, moral point of view, that's an awful lot of money that we're wasting. So, I mean, think about ways. Go on to the Environmental Protection Agency's website, and they've got some tips there about how to store food and make sure it doesn't go off so fast, you know, and just think out, you know, budgets in terms of eating as well, so that we don't waste. So there are things we can do. We're going to have to get a bit smart now if prices are going to start surging in the next while. And the other thing we suffer from, Kieran, and it's very difficult to combat, is shrinkflation when you're shopping. The good might be the same price as it was last week or the week before, but it's in a smaller package or a smaller jar, and that's a real issue, and it's very difficult to deal with that.
And to be honest, based on my very rough calculations there, if you brought down that food waste cost, that €700, to as near as naught as humanly possible, that would more or less offset all of the rest of the price rises the average household might be facing this year.
It could do, yeah, it could do, you know, but you need to, you should be doing everything really, switch around stuff as well, you know, broadband, insurance. I mean, just check that you're on the best deal for everything, whether it's, no matter what it is, and then, yeah, and you're right, and cut down the food waste, because, you know, otherwise we're just, you know, it's, we're making it easy for businesses to make money if we don't become more assertive and more, you know, demanding and savvy, more savvy, I suppose, as consumers. Sometimes businesses find it easy to make money in this country, and it occasionally slips out that they call this country Treasure Island because we don't complain, we don't switch off enough. So don't make it easy for them. Just you know, make sure you get the very best value you can, especially if prices are going up as the way they are at the moment.
Sage advice as always. Charlie Weston, Personal Finance Editor at the Irish Independent. Thanks indeed for joining us. Coming up after the break, how to date again and St. Vincent de Paul's pre-budget submission. St. Vincent de Paul has today launched its pre-budget 2022 submission, with 2022 might seem ages away, but the budget will be out in October, and I imagine all of the departments are already busily putting the final touches to what they wish for budget 2022. So Foundations for an Equal Ireland, it says, according to St. Vincent de Paul, will lay the foundation for an Ireland without poverty. To talk us through this, I'm joined on the line by St. Vincent de Paul's Head of Justice and Policy, Dr. Tricia Keelty. Tricia, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
You have five main pillars in your pre-budget submission. Could you take us through them?
Yes. So I think the main message in our pre-budget submission this year is that given the levels of poverty in Ireland prior to the pandemic and the very uneven impact it has had on Irish society, so we know it's exacerbated issues like food and fuel poverty, educational inequalities, we really need to see the right kind of recovery, and that needs to start with budget 2022, because from our point of view we can't return to the pre-pandemic normality where, you know, a quarter of children are experiencing deprivation, where thousands of people have no place to call home, and many more living in poor quality housing, and so many people are experiencing energy poverty and educational disadvantage. So the five main pillars focus really on addressing poverty and income inequality by ensuring we have adequate social welfare payments and also a living wage for workers, that we have supports for parental employment, you know, so we have investment in good quality, affordable childcare, and also just investing in quality public services like transport, housing, that support the well-being of people, society and the economy. And I suppose from our point of view, you know, we've heard quite a lot about energy price increases in the last number of weeks. And we also know that, you know, environmental taxes also hit people on low incomes very hard. And we know we have to do more in relation to climate action, and we all have a role to play. But we need to ensure that the transition to a low-carbon society is fair and socially just, and that no one is left behind. So we need a strong emphasis on the need to address energy poverty as well.
I think one thing that the state and all of its organs showed us last March and April, 12 months, was just how reactive and proactive it can be, how creative and how fluid. I don't know that many people will have seen that ethos and philosophy carry straight through the rest of the pandemic up to this point as we've experienced it. But it is those kind of qualities and characteristics, Tricia, which would be required to create the kind of reforms that St. Vincent de Paul is calling for.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the pandemic really has shown how vital the role of the state plays in providing basic services for its citizens and the importance of a strong welfare state for everyone. So one example is just the speed at which the pandemic unemployment payment was processed. You know, the frontline Department of Social Protection staff did incredible work in terms of the level of payments that they processed, and the need to and recognise that we needed a higher rate of social welfare payments. And I think that just really reflects also just the inadequacy of existing payments.
And the huge disparity it created in the experience of people who may have been receiving unemployment benefits in, you know, February of 2020 and those who found themselves at the end of March of that year receiving a different kind of much higher employment benefit.
Yeah, so it's you know, many people have to survive on 203 a week, you know, people who have a disability, lone parents, people who are long-term unemployed, and we know that that's just not adequate to meet people's physical, psychological and social needs. So we need to ensure that our social protection system works for everyone. So we want to see progressive realisation of adequate social welfare payments for everyone, and that starts with budget 2022. So we'd like to see a €9.80 increase in core social welfare rates, and then also addressing the very high levels of child poverty we have through extra supports for children as well.
What kind of extra supports do you envisage, Tricia?
So from a social welfare point of view, we'd like to see extra payments for children over the age of 12 where the family is in receipt of social welfare, so a 10 euro increase for that, and also a proportionate increase for children under 12, because we know the cost of raising children is very expensive, particularly if you have a teenager in the household. And at the moment, rates are well below what is required for families to meet a basic standard of living. We also, I think we need to see significant investment in our education system. Again, the move to online learning really expose some of the inequalities that children are faced with in the education system. We, you know, we provided lots of support to families with help with internet bills or with digital devices, but some children just weren't able to keep up with their studies during lockdown. So we need to ensure that we have a good investment in our education system, because it's so vital. And school costs every year cause so much stress and strain for parents. So we want to see an end to the practice of contributions, which puts pressure on families by adequately funding our school system. We'd also like to see a system of free school books as well, and also resources to address the digital divide that became so apparent as well.
Dr. Tricia Keelty, Head of Justice and Policy at St. Vincent de Paul, thank you indeed for joining us. Do remember that the lines are open for comments, requests or dedications. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97. Now, if you are single, and there are 1 million single people in Ireland over the age of 15, going all the way up to whomsoever is the oldest person in Ireland. But if you're thinking about getting back on the dating horse again, either you know, in a COVID safe or COVID friendly way, or perhaps this is just the time in your life where you've decided, right, that's it. It can be a daunting process, but to help you through it, I'm joined on the line now by Mairead Lachman. She's a matchmaker and dating specialist, also the owner of lovehq.ie. Mairead, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hello, how are you, Ciara? Thank you.
And I would say a lot of people are emerging like that butterfly out of their chrysalis back into dating after so many months of lockdown. And they're understandably nervous, A, for the romantic prospects, but B, to ensure that they're COVID safe and COVID compliant.
Absolutely. We've had a huge amount of people that maybe broke up during the lockdown, or maybe were single going into the lockdown and are still single. But also we're seeing a huge surge in the amount of people that have been single for a few years maybe. And, you know, it kind of puts going back onto the dating life and everything on the long finger. And now what they've actually done is they've come to a situation where, you know, when you can't do something, you want to do it more.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden we're getting people. We're like, honestly, it, you know, it is so busy at the moment, and in such a good way, because the great thing is the more people we have in our books, the better the matches we can get. So we have people from all ages, all over the country, from all walks of life as well. Like, we've got people, they're business owners. We've got a lot of teachers at the moment that have just finished up in their summer holidays that are coming to us. We also have a huge amount of farmers, because I've been in the Farmers Journal doing dating tips for the last couple of weeks. I've got a bit of a series going with them. So people from all walks of life. But yes, it is very daunting for people, because, look, I think psychologically we all got out of the whole habit, we'll say, or being used to even chit-chat, you know.
Small talk, like, I have to be honest, I'm not great at small talk in the general course of events. I am entirely out of the habit now, even just, you know, standing in a shop chit-chatting. So I can only imagine what it's like for someone going on a socially distanced coffee date, who's only really talked to whoever might live in their house, or maybe whoever they may work with, or perhaps just the dog. And you know, trying to make small talk and conversation with somebody that they don't yet know that they're interested in.
Absolutely. And, like, you know, for a lot of people it is a nerve-wracking time. Like, I have some of the most successful business people on my books, and, like, they can give up and do a presentation in front of 1,000 people, no problem, and an hour before a date they'd be ringing me going,
I can't.
Like, are you okay? Like, I'm not okay. Wait a second. Like, I'm just a little bit nervous. Can you tell me a little bit about them again? And I'm like, oh my God, you are, like, the most capable person ever. Come on. And do you know what? The nerves only last for, honestly, the first 3 minutes. So what I say to a lot of people is, concentrate on the first 5 minutes of the date. And this is kind of, you can put this into all different areas, whether it's an interview, whether it's life, whether it's just meeting friends. When you arrive there, make sure that you are genuinely happy to see them. So don't be distracted walking in the door, and don't be on your phone and everything. Finish your phone call outside and then walk in to meet them. Walk in and be like, hey, so great to see you. You know, you have to think of the situation as well. We're not able to do handshakes now. We're, you know, a lot of people are like, showing an elbow when they walk towards somebody. But for others, then, like, would you be happy if they stepped towards you, especially in a dating situation? Like, what is going to be your reaction if they step towards you to give you maybe a kiss on the cheek? Are they going to be wearing your mask? Are you going to be wearing your mask? All of those things. So when I press my clients for, before I send them on dates for matchmaking, is, you know, talking them through that situation and making them comfortable with the situation beforehand. Also, as well, is thinking about even the first topic of conversation, getting yourself started. Like, I'm sure Kira's answered the years, especially when you were starting out first, is getting into the whole, you know, when you were interviewing people for radio, you know, once you kind of get the conversation flowing, it does flow from there. So saying to them, look, what would you like, what are the things people are going to ask you about? They're going to ask you, like, how have you been? Has it affected you much? You know, the lockdowns and everything. These are conversations that are going to be had. But also things like, how long are you single?
There's a certain, I suppose, list of questions that, that can be expected. I mean, it would throw people somewhat if it turned into being particularly, let's say, like a job interview. What are your strengths and weaknesses? Because I'd be there, no, I'm leaving now. Sorry, thanks. My strength and my weakness is to recognise the poor nature of that question.
I think to kind of keep the nerves low is to make sure that you're building a connection with people. So look, there has to be a certain level of chit-chat. But if you're genuinely interested in the person and, you know, asking them questions like say if they say they're a nurse and say it must have been very difficult to be a nurse during the pandemic, actually asking them questions like, is that something you always wanted to do when you were growing up? And then also open questions like, what's your favourite part of your job? So it doesn't need to necessarily be about your job. It could be about your hobbies. It could be about things, random things. Some people have the quirkiest things, hobbies and pastimes when they come to me. And just, you know, kind of having an idea of what topics of conversation you can kind of pull out of your back pocket as well. So being prepared.
Also, like, strategically, and I don't necessarily like to use the word strategically when we're talking about people meeting for the first time with both of them holding the hope of romance in their heart. But asking questions in that way gives you the time to settle as well, because you're focused on hearing about the other person, finding things that you might find of interest to them, which will calm you down and then leave you open to, I suppose, a more flowing conversation.
I really believe that. And also, I think it's very important. Some people are great at chatting and some people are not so great at chatting. So also remembering that it's a conversation, it's not a monologue. So both of you should be talking about 50-50, okay? But you should never be talking more than 60%, or you should never be just listening less, you know, 40% is what I would say. So, you know, you have to put a little bit of effort in to the whole conversation. Some people can a little bit take over. I've had clients where I've said to them, you know, I want you to talk actually less, like half of what you're talking now.
Was that too diplomatically not saying, please stop talking?
Yeah, but it really is, okay? But they've come to me for help, okay? They have come to me. And also, you know, anybody that's coming to me for dating is looking for help, for advice. They're looking for a result. They, you know, something is not working in their dating life, whether it just be that they're not meeting enough people. But very often that can be because they talk so much online or they talk so much on the phone before they don't even get to the date stage. So whatever it is that I feel that I can help them with along the way, absolutely. But like that as well, some people can be painfully shy, and I understand this. So I very often work on people's dating confidence and building up a bit of rapport. Things like as well, a lot of people may have put up, you know, a little bit of weight during the lockdowns and everything. So making sure you have a great outfit to wear out, that you're ready, that you're going to feel great, regardless of what way your body may have changed or your confidence levels about your appearance. Like, you know, getting your hair done, like everybody should have gotten their hair done at this stage. You know, for ladies, wearing nice makeup, wearing shoes that you can walk in. For a lot of people, they haven't walked in high heels for a long time. There is so many things we have to take into consideration going on dates at the moment.
But I would imagine ultimately, Mairead, view it for what it is. It's your first meeting with a person and it need be no more nor no less than that.
Yeah, absolutely. And for people that haven't met before, I think they need to remember that it's a general meet and greet for the first time you're meeting them. I really don't even know if I consider it a first date, okay? So the first time you're meeting a complete stranger, you're literally meeting them to see, one, if you like them and if you'd like to meet again. But there's a lot of other things going on. When you're going into a date, what's happening is your pheromones and their pheromones are bouncing against each other. And essentially, these are hormones that are released from the body to basically let you subconsciously know whether or not they would be a good match. Now, it's for people of all ages have pheromones, But essentially what it's doing, it's for procreation reasons. Mm. If you were to have babies, would they have a diverse gene pool? So if one person has weak kidneys and the other has really strong kidneys, they might really work well together. That's why some people have great chemistry with each other and other people don't have great chemistry with each other. So you have to remember, all of that stuff is going on in the background as well. I'm recording my podcasts again at the moment, and yesterday I was speaking with Sabina Brennan. She's a neuroscientist, and we're talking about all the other stuff that's going on when you meet somebody.
That so, you're not in any way, shape or form consciously aware of, but is happening nonetheless. It's fascinating.
Absolutely. And all the stuff. So some people are very hard on themselves when it comes to dating. Some people are like, why is it not working for me? Like, I present myself in the very best way. You know, we had lots of things in common. But sometimes it genuinely can be, you know, everything to do with neuroscience, your pheromones, your so many other things that are going on, your body language, everything that you kind of do subconsciously and unconsciously.
One particular scenario in which I imagine even meeting up with someone very casually, coffee, you know, socially distanced, it's still a date in your mind, even though it's not a date, but it is a date. And I would say it's incredibly difficult, whatever about people who may have been actively dating before the pandemic, is for people who are maybe coming out of a long-term relationship for whom the dating landscape has changed fundamentally since they were last courting.
It is very difficult. It can be very daunting. You're meeting a completely new person. You do kind of have an expectation of what they might possibly be based on, you know, your previous partner that you know so well for so long. And you also have to remember, when people are starting back into the dating situation, there's a lot of other stuff going on as well. So things like, if you have been single for a while, because it might have taken you a long time to get over your last relationship, if you've been single for a while and you're now a little bit lonely, you might be completely happy with your life, but you might be a little bit lonely for a romantic partner in your life. What's happening there is, sometimes when you go on a date, your boundaries may be a little bit lower. So what I'm kind of warning my matchmaking clients about at the moment is, you know, a few dates in, asking yourself as well, is this what I want? Do I want to date this person, or am I dating them because I'm a little bit lonely? Because it's very important you don't waste people's time, but it's also important you don't waste your own time and that you really are trusting your gut, listening to your instinct. But for anybody that has been single for a long time or is entering back in after a long-term relationship, you know, what I'd say to them is, tread carefully, make sure as well you're ready. For some people, I would say to them, possibly look at going to counselling. Have you been to counselling, or have you spoken to somebody about being ready and your feelings? And possibly as well, if someone's coming out of an abusive relationship, or maybe dated someone with an addiction or something like that, you know, kind of looking at possible patterns that may arise before you go dating. Because by thinking through a lot of these things, because what happens is, when we meet somebody, your body is going to be filling with all these hormones, dopamine, and making, kind of flooding your judgment. First of all, there's going to be all kind of chemicals, or, you know, jumping around your body to do with love and lust and all those fabulous things. So we do have rose tinted glasses on. So it's making sure that we have a clear head going in, knowing what our boundaries are, knowing that there might be expectations there as well. So what happens when you're presented with these, so that you're not, you know, maybe jumping to the defense, and or also going with the flow, because you don't want to stop it, you know?
Well, get your house in order first. Wise words there from Mairead Lachman, matchmaker and dating specialist, also owner of lovehq.ie. A new report by the Irish Refugee Council shows that the average person who is seeking asylum in Ireland is waiting 2 years, and there are 5,000 people awaiting the processing of their application. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Nick Henderson, Chief Executive of the Irish Refugee Council. Nick, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much for having me.
Delighted to do so. That 5,000 is more than the population of some of the smaller towns and villages here in Kildare. It's a huge number of people.
Yeah, it's a huge number of people. And what we're experiencing, I suppose, is a bit of a perfect storm, where we had delays and backlogs before the pandemic. But since the pandemic began in March of last year, decision-making bodies the International Protection Office and the Protection Appeals Tribunal have been closed on and off because of level 5 restrictions and so on. So cases haven't been processed, people haven't been interviewed. So this has caused the waiting time to shoot up, as you say. So if you or I claimed asylum today, it's likely that we'd be waiting 2 years for a decision, unless those decision-making bodies can really start to reduce their backlogs, but that seems slightly unlikely.
I was just going to say, how probable is that? I would imagine that none of those decision-making bodies have received any additional resources or personnel in order to clear the backlogs.
Yeah, resources is one of the things that we're calling for and have done for some time. Both bodies, particularly the International Protection Office, often say that they are under-resourced or that they would have a high turnover of staff. People would arrive, get skilled and experienced, and then move on. But I think, stepping back slightly, one of the things that we would be recommending as an organization, and we don't say this lightly, because we're committed to case processing, committed to the processing of law, one of the things that we would be saying is that people who've been waiting in the system for more than 2 years should be offered permission to remain to try and deal with this backlog that we have.
I'm wondering what effect this backlog, because as you've noted, Nick, it's not going to be cleared in any way approaching a speedy fashion without additional resources to the decision-making bodies. But could this backlog, because it will continue to grow without some kind of sea change, have an impact on the plans to end the Direct Provision Centre by 2024, which already seemed ambitious at best?
Yeah, indeed, completely. That's the point, I suppose, in that we have 7,000 people in direct provision and emergency accommodation at the moment, and creating a new system of accommodation with 7,000 people in it is going to be a lot harder than, say, 3,000 or 3,500 people in it. So the system is in effect, and plans to end direct provision will in effect be going ahead with almost like a ball and chain around it, dragging this backlog in front of it. And that was really clearly identified by Catherine Day in the advisory group report that was published in October of last year, that ending the backlog is crucial to ending direct provision, in effect.
But because it does seem that the system as presented by Roderick O'Gorman in February is specifically designed for a significantly lower number of people in that system or seeking asylum, and that the range of provisions, all of which are very welcome to be made for the people who may be in that system at that time, are contingent on low numbers.
Yeah, the figure that given is, as far as I can recall, 3,500 people. In 2019, 4,600 people claimed asylum, and then in 2020, it was 1,600. Huge drop because of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. 3,500 is, I think, there was reason and methodology behind that figure, and I think it is a reasonable figure to project forward. And figures do remain low so far for 2021 as well. But as you say, there is a lot of numbering being done behind this, and that 3,500 figure, if it were to increase, things would change slightly. But we would say that starting afresh and resetting the system, that's what I suppose why that's necessary, to reset so we can start from a more or less blank canvas, as opposed to dragging cases along behind us.
Do you have any sense, Nick, that anything will occur between today and whatever date has been selected in 2024 for the end of direct provision to bring that number of people, and we are talking about people, not random numbers, down from the current 7,000 to 3,500?
Yeah, so the white paper is a broad-ranging document published in February, and what we've seen in that is that recommendations that fell to the responsibility of the Department of Children are gradually being acted on, but the recommendations falling to the Department of Justice, which would be issues around the backlog and decision-making, they were, generally speaking, kicked ahead almost to the end of 2022. So I think the phrasing is they'll be reviewed by the end of 2022. So I suppose that's disappointing, and I think it's going to be a problem. And the can is being kicked down the road. well, we are saying in this report, act now, start dealing with this issue now, so that we can, the whole of white paper approach can be successful, but kicking it to the end of 2022, when levels of people seeking protection in Ireland will probably return to pre-pandemic levels within the year, we do have a moment now to act.
Do you have any sense that there is the desire to take that action?
Good question. We remain sort of positive in outlook. Generally, the white paper is forwarded by the Taoiseach. It's a coalition government. I think the Green Party has done the hard yards in terms of getting this into the programme for government, getting the white paper over the line, particularly Minister Roderick O'Gorman. But now it shifts to some implementation, which will require a range of different government departments. And the Taoiseach, the leader, will have to be a driving force behind this, and responsibility also falls to Department of Finance and Department of Public Expenditure as well, and the Department of Housing. And, you know, there's different ministers from different parties are, I think, Fine Gael with Justice, Fianna Fáil with Housing, and Green Party with the Department of Children. So there's three different parties, three different ministers. Mm. So that could be a challenge, but I suppose we all have to look to the forward and the ultimate aim of the white paper, which was to end direct provision, which all parties seem to have bought into.
Nick Henderson, Chief Executive of the Irish Refugee Council, thank you indeed for your time.